This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. I believe the phrase goes, Manchester is red, North London is red, everywhere is red except Liverpool, which isn't red or blue, it's just sad. Erik ten Hag's men turn it around late on against City, and clearly last season Marcus Rashford wouldn't have been interfering even if he was that close to the ball. But right now it's a different story, but Pep doesn't care. He's won loads of football matches, these ones don't matter. Meanwhile, Arsenal beat Spurs in just such an obvious way, deservedly 8 points clear at the top of the league, barely having to try to beat Tottenham, so lacking in anything good. Who knows how many managers will be gone just after we finish recording, but crisis klaxons are sounding all over the country. Lampard, Moyes, Rodgers and Klopp, Cuthbert, Dibble and Grubb. Also today, double hit penalties, 8.5 year contracts and a James Ward-Prowse free kick. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jonathan Wilson, good morning.
Morning, how are you doing?
Very good, thank you. Troy Townsend, hello.
Morning, Max.
Fraser says, welcome at Bearded Genius, smiley face emoji. No one has been that popular before. They've even been on the pod for their bread and butter debut. Noradine Chowdhury, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very good. Well, you are great. You're a Manchester United
fan. I am, yeah.
We'll start there. Why not at Old Trafford? Man United 2, Manchester City 1. Tim says, which article will Wilson be reusing this week? That United are better without Ronaldo, or that City have issues conceding goals in quick succession in big games? Let's stop before we go there, Wilson. We'll start with the turning point, the Bruno Fernandes goal, because it was like a key moment in this game. Manuel Akanji said, to be honest, the first goal is a joke. He runs until the last second. He stops when the ball is in front of him, and he's right in front of Eddie. That's Edison. Ready to score the goal. Charlie says, should referees use rules to decide offsides or how pundits feel the rules should be? And Dan says, on the perfectly legal Fernandes goal, does Rashford really influence City players? Their stride doesn't stop. If he stops his run, Fernandes is still first on the ball. Noz, your objective here. How did you view this goal?
Well, it was clearly onside. I mean, there's no debate, is there? I mean, it's just it's churlish to suggest otherwise. No, it was just mad. Like, I mean, first of all, like, obviously Rashford's running to the ball, but then you kind of think he does so well not to touch it. Like, quite apart from anything else, it's like he's like walking on hot coals of like, oh, like inches away. And it's even watching the replay, it's kind of like it's thrilling. It's thrilling to see the way he avoids it. If anything, he's chaperoning the ball. He's kind of, and this thing about interfering with play, like. Is Joel the producer interfering with this podcast?
It's very unlikely. Like it, just turns his screen off and buggers off. No idea.
But it's that thing of it's a strange one because if you look at the actual rules as were set out like on Match of the Day or from what I've seen, like technically you could argue he's not breaking the rules, even though it's ridiculous because he obviously is like the City defenders. If they just had Bruno standing there or sort of running onto it, like this three of them around him, like they would cope with it. But it's just like I just find it hilarious. The biggest thing for me is I totally get City fans being irate about it because I would. I totally get opposition fans getting annoyed. I don't understand United fans getting annoyed back and trying to argue the case. Like, surely you take great, like it's a derby. You've got an ill-gotten sort of goal or a dubious goal at best. Like that is manna from heaven. That's better than like a 40-yard screamer. You should revel in that. You shouldn't. It's not a case of sort of like, oh no, I now have to. It's now a debating society after the game. Like you don't need to win the debate. You've won the game.
Wilson, you were there. What was the chat about when that goal went in?
Well, it was one of those in the press box. Everybody thought it was offside when you know your instinct, all your football watching instincts say this is offside, and you think, yeah, Kanji stepped up. He's clearly 2 or 3 yards off. And then as soon as there was a moment of delay, he's like, hang on, he hasn't touched it, has he? If he hasn't touched it, maybe the way the law, or rather the guidelines of the law now are, maybe that does count. And then I think there's an odd thing happens, which is, because you see, it wasn't a VAR decision. I saw a lot of people in the moment saying, oh, it's a VAR decision. It wasn't a VAR decision. It was Stuart Atwell went over to Darren Cann and obviously asked him, who have you flagged offside there? And Darren Cann presumably has said, I flagged Rashford off. It's up to you to decide whether he was interfering or not. And in that moment, Stuart Atwell decides, no, he wasn't interfering. I think that decision is not obviously wrong enough for VAR to overturn it. But I also think that, and that technically under the guidelines they've been given, that may even be the correct decision. In terms of how football should be played, how football has always been played, it's an absolute nonsense. Clearly, Akanji's whole decision-making, his reactions, all his movements are conditioned by Rashford, and Rashford is offside, and therefore that should be given as offside. And I think, you know, I would also say on Salah goal against Wolves last week, I think is in a similar category. It's a different part of the law, but where our attempts to codify what is and isn't interfering has made the thing a nonsense, that you have defenders taking defensive actions, whether that be stepping up to play a player offside or whether it be trying to head a ball clear, that they only take because that player is there in an offside position. And then somehow that counts against them. Whereas if they performed the action badly, somehow they'd be better off. And that can't be right.
Yeah, but maybe if Rashford, instead of shepherding the ball expertly, as you say, like a centre-back trying to get a goal kick, just going, you know, just like sort of like one man and his dog, it was just beautifully done. But if he just stopped straight away, Troy, then maybe I can see a case for it. If he just put his hands up and going, I'm not taking any part in this, you know, begone ball, not let me follow you, come by.
He almost had the ball on the string, didn't he? He was literally running with the ball in between his feet. He's already evoked the actions of the Man City defence, as both have mentioned there. But also, very importantly, Edison's stance as well. I'm not a goalkeeper. I don't pronounce to be a goalkeeper, but I'm joining the union. I joined it on Saturday afternoon and I'm going to continue to join it and stay with it, because Edison's looking at the shape of Rashford's run, the angle of Rashford's run, and is following that. I think they showed it last night really well, and is following that all the way through. And you can see where his eyes are fixated on. And then all of a sudden pops this Abbas, red, and puts the ball in the back of the net. It, for me, it's a scandalous decision. Jonathan, are you saying that VAR didn't look at it because they were happy with the referee's decision and didn't want to influence that decision at all?
Well, because I think the reason VAR doesn't get involved is that they would say whether he's interfering or not is a subjective decision, and Stuart Atwell has made that decision on the pitch and they will not overturn that. Is my understanding why VAR doesn't get involved. Because what I also liked, just from the aesthetic point of view, one of the great things in football is when a linesman talks to a referee and you've got this sort of posse of angry players on both sides surrounding them, trying to influence them, but also not trying to influence, you know, if you get too close, you might sort of, you know, flip them the wrong way. So you've got to sort of apply the right amount of pressure. With all the headsets and mics, they've ruined that. They just sort of stand there with their fingers in their ear. This Atwell went over to him. And so it was Bill Troop talking to Ray Tinkler at Elland Road, 1971, trying to decide if Colin Suggett had been interfering or not. The scandalous, and Leeds have gone mad and have every right to go mad. That goal, which also won Arsenal the title, as I suspect this one might end up doing. From a neutral point of view, it's a beautiful thing to see. Two middle-aged men talking seriously behind their hands, nodding a bit, then pointing, while lots of athletes in brightly coloured clothing shout at them. It's a great thing.
It is. I mean, people will yell at us for only talking about this decision before we go on to the whole game, Noz. But, like, it must be so odd for a Manchester United fan to be good again. To, you know, like, you, this is... You know, are the barren years over? It's almost a decade, is it, of being shite?
I mean, I still refuse to accept that we're good again. It's like, I saw Newcastle fans saying, oh, suddenly Manchester United are being talked about as being part of the title challenge. Surely that means we are as well. And it's like, neither of us are. Like, it's just not happening. It's almost like, do you know when those VHS boxes used to come out of, like, the race for the title? At the end of seasons, when VHS videos were still a thing, and it used to have like the four or five teams that are challenging for the title on the cover, with the winner in the middle. Like at the moment, I'm happy to be on that cover. I'm happy to be on that VHS cover. little things could sort of knock them on, off course. Like it could be like a Varane injury, or it could be Bruno getting injured for Newcastle. So yeah, it's great. It's great at the moment. And from my point of view, like I'd scratched that off as like a defeat. So I was kind of thinking, oh, we're gonna lose City. But then I factored that in my head. So no, it was great, and it's great to see a manager who impacts the game, and he's constantly changing things, and things like bringing on Garnacho, because like he could see that the City players were pushing forward, and that could either leave space behind them or bringing somebody on could pin them back. The way he's turned Shaw into like Beckenbauer, it's great. Like the little things, like fans love little things like that.
To be fair, if he's turned Luke Shaw into Franz Beckenbauer, that's not a little thing.
Gav says, how does Haaland fit into the Al Nassr team next season, Wilson? I mean, it's all this talk now of, you know, if City don't win anything. Were City bad on Saturday?
No.
Were United better?
Yeah. I don't think City were anywhere near their best. I think, actually, the first half... I don't know how much the television coverage made of this, but it was really windy. And it was a strange sort of gusting wind. So, I sort of realised quite early that loads of players who were misplacing passes, you wouldn't expect to misplace passes. Loads of players are miscontrolling the ball. Casemiro miscontrolled two passes that he just shouldn't have. De Bruyne was really struggling with his range early on.
Was it windy at Spurs yesterday? For Spurs players, we'll get on to that.
Edison's kicking was really bad. I think those two one-on-one chances Rashford had in the first half, I think both of them, I think the first one was touches too heavy, the second one was touches too light. I think both of them is because the wind affected the flight of the ball. It was a real, really odd gusting wind. If I hadn't seen City be so bad at Southampton in the Carabao Cup, and I know a lot of the players were different, I would just say, look, the conditions were really difficult. The first half was United's positionally were really good. They made it really hard for City. But it was quite a sort of scrappy, patchy game. And then the way it seemed to be going was City have such a strong bench. Yet again, they bring a player off a bench who scores a goal, as they had done at Chelsea in the league before the Cup game, when it was Grealish crossing for Mahrez. Here it was Grealish scoring the goal. And so the sort of story that's sort of beginning to form is, City weren't great, but conditions were difficult. It's a derby. They've got the win because of the strength of their bench, and that's probably what's going to carry them to the title. But then the story becomes the offside decision.
Rashford could just say he was blown along, like that he wasn't even trying.
Yeah, he was just like a crisp packet. Yeah. It becomes two things. So one is this habit City have, or Guardiola teams generally, not just City, have had, of conceding goals in quick succession, twos and threes, and you can go back. The game against Liverpool in the Champions League that was 3-0 by half time. Yeah, it's happened against Leicester a couple of times.
Crystal Palace did it, Jonathan.
Crystal Palace, yeah. The Liverpool game where Liverpool ended up winning 4-3, but they went 4-1 up early in the second half. There's a whole load of examples where, for whatever reason, they concede one and then they concede one or two within sort of 5-10 minutes. The Monaco games, the Real Madrid game last season. And it seems to be that because the mechanism is so sophisticated, because the way they play is more important than the individual, that you offset that and you dislodge that, and it just sort of goes haywire. And there's no sort of players there in the manner of, say, a Roy Keane, to grab the game and say, right, this isn't happening, and just calm everything down for 5 or 10 minutes, that the players are so subordinate to the system that they lose that little bit of leadership.
Sorry, I butted in there, Max. Crystal Palace, 22nd of December 2018. I mean, there's a couple of fabulous goals in that game. I'm not quite sure who scored.
Dave says, would letting Qatar buy Spurs so I can stop supporting them on principle be the easiest way out of my torment? Adam says, do we need to taking Arsenal seriously more seriously? Troy, Arsenal, I thought, won this game. I thought they were brilliant, but I felt they didn't really have to be brilliant to win the North London Derby.
No, they didn't, unfortunately. But their first half, Arsenal's first half was very good, very, very good. The dominated possession. But still, you have to go to the key point in that first half, and that's whatever Hugo Lloris was doing. After that deflection, he made a mistake at Villa the other week as well, didn't he? And that gives Arsenal the initiative to go on and play out their game plan. Spurs were in no position whatsoever to come up against Arsenal at home. The fans were quiet by just after Lloris' score. Then it was almost like Spurs went back to type and were waiting for the second half to surge back into the game. But Arsenal were very good. You know, this is a sticky fixture for them. They haven't won at White Hart Lane, Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, or wherever else Spurs have been playing for quite a while. So you could tell, and we'll probably get onto the celebrations at the end, but you could tell by the end of it, it was a massive, massive win. Because of how close everyone else is getting, I love the fact that Man United, who have been longing to get back into the title race, are now saying that they're not in the title race, even though they're only a point behind Man City, by the way. But no, it was a great fixture. Spurs, too many players, as in recent weeks, just not on it. Just absolutely not on it. And Arsenal were as comfortable as you can be in a North London derby, particularly in the first half. And then they dropped deeper in the second half. And just watch Spurs play in front of them. Absolutely dominated the game.
Tony says, has Hugo Lloris forgotten that he's only retired from international football? Which I quite enjoyed. And compared to Ramsdale, who just did everything he needed to do. I mean, the gulf, Noz, between these two sides is enormous. And Arsenal have these things like patterns of play and pressing and control and being comfortable in tight spaces. And I was obviously watching this with a very Spursy lens, which is a lens that just is broken. And just really, it was very bleak for me. But like, you have to give Arsenal and Arteta so much credit.
Oh yeah, like I've heard some people sort of suggest, oh, the goalkeepers were ultimately the difference, and that might be true to a small extent. Like Lloris, like I still don't understand. Like I'm not a goalkeeper. But like, I still don't understand what was going on there. Like it was like he was surprised to be there. It was like that exact moment, like Sam Beckett had quantum leaped into his body. He's like, oh boy, like, whoa, what do I do? But it's that thing that, like you were saying, like Arsenal look like a proper team now. And there's been periods, there's been seasons in the past where Arsenal look really good, especially going forward. But you kind of get the feeling that, okay, it's just a good bit of form they're going through, or they're just one injury away from sort of collapsing, or mentally things will get to them. There's been no sign of that. Any talk about City, about Arsenal falling away this season, at the moment, I just can't see it. They've coached with injuries. They've maintained their sort of their charge. Like the World Cup hasn't destabilized their sort of run at all. And in that game, like, they played really, really well in the first half, as bad as Spurs were. But the second half was almost more impressive, because that's the side that Arsenal need to show to win the league. Like, that second half is what wins you the league. This thing about Spurs, accepting the fact that Spurs are going to be crap in the first half and then they're going to come good in the second half. Like, I don't get how that happens. I don't get how collectively they managed to do that. Like, it's almost impressive that keeps on happening. But also, like, so knowing that Spurs are going to come back in the second half, and Spurs did put a lot of pressure on. And Arsenal, the thing about Arsenal not getting out of third gear in terms of the attacking in the first half, like the second half, they didn't really struggle that much with like the Alamo or Spurs version of the Alamo. And it was kind of too easy for them.
I don't know what the bookmakers' odds suggest, but for me, it's the first time now I think Arsenal are favoured to win the title, because they can mess up. Well, they can lose two games and draw a game and still be top. And also, City just don't look as remorseless as they have done in previous seasons. I don't know if the World Cup has played a trick on us mentally, that there's still 20 games to go. Yeah, we're not halfway yet. I sort of feel that we've come back from a World Cup and we're talking about this as the run-in. But actually, yeah, we're nowhere near the run-in yet. And I don't know if that's just sort of skewed our perceptions of where we are in the season. I can't quite work out what I normally think after 18 games of a season, because it's not something you normally have to think about, right? If the positions were switched and City were 8 points clear, you would say that City have got the league wrapped up. You wouldn't be able to see a way that City would lose it. I still think, I mean, Smith Rowe coming back, you played against Oxford, coming off the bench yesterday, that's a huge thing for them, because that was the area where you sort of, oh yeah, one injury there and it could be in a bit of bother. But Smith Rowe you can cover so many positions in that forward line. Yeah, it is a little bit more strength and depth, but they still don't really have strength and depth. If they were to get two or three injuries in quick succession, you still think they could falter. But yeah, I think right now I'd say Arsenal are marginal favourites.
Troy, most Spurs fans are focusing their ire more on Daniel Levy than they are on Antonio Conte. Is Conte getting a bit of a pass here? Because, like Mike says, is it worth Spurs backing a manager who isn't invested in the club long term, has 6 months left on his contract, plays insipid football, doesn't improve any players? Is sacking him, brackets getting Poch back, the an answer? Or is Conte this born winner that it just doesn't feel any different to Mourinho football? It really doesn't to me.
I've seen a change in what Spurs fans are thinking. And I think, yes, while Daniel Levy and the board get a lot of criticism as always, I think there's a lot of fans that now believe that Conte is not the one. And that all of the things that you've just described there, you know, his style of football is not easy on the eye. The development of players, we've seen Song go backwards. We've seen quite a number of players just not up to the task, or maybe not up to what he wants to deliver. I've always said this, that a lot of those Spurs players do not seem like they're progressing, but is it about the players more than the manager, more than the board? But then you look at this team that absolutely blew Arsenal away only in May of last year, and now you see an Arsenal team full of development, full of togetherness, their ability shining through against a set of non-functional players who have a limited game plan with no real design on where they want to be and what they want to do. And ultimately, the manager's in control of that. And ultimately, it's the manager who will take the flak because of that. I mean, are they going to sign players? Maybe they're not trusting Conte with money now as well. So I can see why he gets stick. I can see why the fans are now, you know, looking at multiple different avenues and thinking that's the problem, that's the problem, and that's the problem. And honestly, I don't think he'll stay. I don't think he'll stay. I don't think the fit between the club, between the manager and between the players is a good one at the moment. I'm not quite sure how long this can continue, to be totally honest.
Ian says, is the best punishment for the brainless fan kicking Ramsdale being banned from the second half of Spurs matches and having to attend the first half? Yeah, and what an idiot. Ramsdale was kicked afterwards. He said, the Spurs fans gave me some throughout the game. I was giving some back. The people I did give it to greeted it in a sportsmanlike terms. He says, one fan tried to give me a little punch on the back. Spurs said the fan would face an immediate ban. That'll do for part one. Part two, a lot of clubs in crisis. Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Brighton 3, Liverpool 0. John says, is this season time to rename the Everton Cup the Liverpool Cup? I mean, the Everton Cup is something wildly different now. We'll get to that, Troy. Don't worry. Klopp said this was his worst game ever at Liverpool. Not as your obviously objective once again. how did you find this one?
Glorious. I mean, what I do, because I am such a petty little man, is whenever Liverpool lose, I love... First of all, I love tuning into Radio Merseyside just to listen to the phone-ins. but secondly,
God, Radio Merseyside must have been amazing.
It was genuinely amazing. Like it was like the poor guy in the studio was being double teamed by these angry Everton fans 1 minute, angry Liverpool fans the next. He did such a good job of coping with it. But and also I listened to a number of Liverpool podcasts, which are actually very good, and it's kind of sad I can only listen to them when Liverpool lose. But I don't think anyone's turning on Klopp in terms of, oh, Klopp out, or anyone sensible. But I think there's there's doubts coming in about certain aspects of the way he's managing the situation. And I think that's absolutely valid. Like, it doesn't matter how good your manager is. It doesn't matter if it's Pep Guardiola, it doesn't matter if it's Alex Ferguson, whoever, everyone, you're well within your rights to like complain about certain things and be aggrieved about certain things while still respecting the manager and wanting them to stay. I think the thing I've noticed with Liverpool fans is there's a concern that Klopp can't do it on his own, and with various people behind the scenes leaving Liverpool. Has that destabilised things to the extent that he's lost some of what made him a great manager and made Liverpool a great team in terms of them working collectively?
I think the problem is that we knew really, even last season, might even mean the season before, that Liverpool had the highest average age of players who'd started games. So you knew that they were coming into a period of transition, and that's always difficult. You know, the hardest thing for managers to do is to take apart the thing that's worked, and to have that ruthlessness. Maybe Klopp doesn't have the same ruthlessness that say, Paisley did or a Ferguson did. And the problem is, as they've been going through this period of transition, which was going to be difficult anyway, they've been hit by this absurd injury crisis. I mean, the number of players they've got out is ridiculous, and so probably the players who they're trying to transit out are having to play every week anyway. I'm guessing the plan wasn't to have Fabinho and Jordan Henderson starting most weeks. But then again, yeah, they're only, 29 and 32. They're not ancient. I think the other thing that's become really noticeable this season is Salah just seems... Basically, I don't think Salah's played well since he came back from the Cup of Nations. I can imagine playing under Carlos Queiroz is a pretty miserable experience, and it seems to have really knocked him. I don't know if he was more involved in the game before or whether... He's always done the same thing. It's just that Liverpool aren't pressing as well, and so the ball's not getting to him as much. And that, I think, has put extra pressure on Alexander-Arnold. I think with Henderson not really playing as well, that he was always a link between the two. So I think the reason it's gone so badly wrong so quickly is it's just inherent in that style of play. You saw it at Dortmund as well, that if you play this very sophisticated pressing game that demands absolute buy-in from everybody, that one player being 5% off, has this huge ripple effect on everybody. It changes everybody's roles. If rather than picking on individuals, say you notice that the left winger isn't pressing enough, so the left midfielder has to then cover for that, so he's not in quite the same position, so the centre midfielder has to cover across, and that has an impact on the centre back. All that ripple effect going through, people start to lose form, and so the whole thing then disintegrates. Whereas maybe in a more old-fashioned style of play, it's easier for a player just to get on with doing his job. And if one player's a bit off, it doesn't quite have the same effect over everybody. So I suspect that's what's gone wrong. But the nature of the style of play is one or two players being off can have a huge detrimental effect on the whole. Then everybody starts being off and the whole thing spirals out of control.
We had a tweet, and forgive me, I've forgotten who sent it, saying, look, whenever Brighton beat someone good, it's crisis at that club and not Brighton are good. And, Kieran Maguire tweeting, they're starting 11. Cost £31 million. Right? And they are, and we talked about, Spurs players not improving. These players, like Solly March, looks like a world beater, and he definitely didn't 2 years ago. This is Potter, his legacy, and De Zerbi taking it on a step.
Yeah, I was going to say we've spent far too long on Liverpool than Brighton, because Brighton were exceptional, and we've got to identify and pick out the team that's dominated the game and won the game at a canter, and Brighton did that. Regardless of whether it's Liverpool or whoever it may be, praise, we have to give the praise where it's due. And Solly March, like you said, my notes here, was always looked a good player, but never truly hit the heights consistently. Well, he got two and created one as well. And we've got Danny Welbeck coming on with a throwback to Paul Gascoigne. They were just, like I said, they've moved on from the previous manager who did ever so well. But they've gone on to another level, and that other level is being able to put the ball, just being able to put the ball in the back of the net, finish off some really good moves, entertain as they've always done, but looking like a real good, solid team. Where are they now? I think they're seventh in the league. Let's have a look, just a point behind Fulham. They're above Liverpool. They're looking upwards, definitely looking upwards, and their goal difference record is a lot better than definitely what it used to be as well. So a very proactive team. I think it was really interesting that Solly March said that the gaffer, as a gaffer, I'm saying, look, almost as if I'm part of Brighton squad there, but yeah, has improved him no end, and how much he's enjoying playing under him. And I don't think that's a slight on Potter. I just think someone's come in and tinkered some things, and like you said, with the money they've spent and the recruitment drive at that football. Everyone talks about the recruitment drive at Brentford, but the recruitment drive here at Brighton has been equally as good. We've spoken about Matoma, we've spoken about them bringing players, Ferguson from the academy, and they're working to the max of their ability, and that ability is top class. And regardless of whether Liverpool were poor or not, you've still got to take advantage of it. And Brighton did that so well.
There's a pattern you occasionally see in sports. I think you can see it with Michael Vaughan replacing Nasser Hussain as England cricket captain. I think you can see it at the Ajax of the early 70s when you had Reinus Michels followed by Stefan Kovac. That you have a very, very good coach or captain who's essentially quite cautious and conservative and makes that team hard to beat and puts the defence in place. And then they get a more attacking coach, a more expressive figure in charge, and they reach a new level that they probably wouldn't quite have reached under that previous coach. And I wonder if almost by accident, with losing Potter, Brighton are going through that same thing, that Potter got all the basics right, he got the basic structures, he made them very hard to beat, and now they've got De Zerbi, who can take it on to a different level and make them, a really good, well-balanced team who can attack as well as defend. And perhaps if Potter hadn't been there, De Zerbi wouldn't have been as effective coming in. And I think that's also, it's an almost impossible thing for a board to plan, because you've got the bloke who's made you way better than you were. But if you, through circumstance, can replace the bloke who's got the basics right with the bloke who can put the bells and whistles on top at exactly the right moment, you can achieve incredible things. And I think that is possibly what Brighton are doing at the moment.
It's good news for Chelsea fans in about 4 years when De Zerbi comes in. Daniel says, is Liverpool-Chelsea next week going to be the biggest ninth versus 10th clash in Premier League history? That is wild, isn't it? Let's go to Goodison. William says, is Troy contractually obliged to be on after Everton have had a shocker? No, it's just Troy is on sometimes. So that's how it works. We'll start on the pitch, Noz. James Ward-Prowse, two brilliant free goals from him, one a free kick and one great control. Robin says, at what point do teams' goalkeepers try something different against James Ward-Prowse? Walls don't work. Surely you have better rods standing in the middle with no wall blocking your line of sight.
Or have players on the posts or something. He's just so good. Like I think Nathan Jones said he's the best technician in the league. And it's it's hard to argue with that. His sort of control of the ball when he hits the ball is outstanding. And it's that thing of sometimes the free kicks almost work against him because there's a feeling of that's what he does. That's his game. And it's not. He's technically so good and he adds so much to that team. And yeah, but again, it's that thing of sometimes it's great when you've got a great player who stays at a Southampton or we talk about Brighton, it would be great if they could keep the fulcrum of that team and sort of build on that. It's not always necessary or it's not always for the neutral. It's not always great when these players move on because it'd be great if Ward-Prowse becomes another Letizia, albeit sort of not turn into a lunatic in about 20 years' time. But yeah.
Meanwhile, Troy, and we'll keep it on the pitch to begin with, Everton were bad again.
No, they weren't. No, it was a competitive first half. They were bad again after half time, which then alludes back to the team talk, what happens in that team talk. But I thought it was a very good first half. Onana was outstanding, to be fair, and deserved his goal and was everything. He was swashbuckling. He was all over the place. He was driving the team forward. He was getting back, making last-ditch tackles. Someone's going to come in for him when whatever happens with Everton happens, because he's too good a player to be where he is at the moment. And he was brilliant. Southampton, to be fair, they were in the game. They were tidy. And then James Ward-Prowse had that chance just before half-time that Pickford put. Max, I wanted to talk to you about all the shots on target there were this weekend that hit the post and come out again that, we're still going to have that discussion with. But it was almost
not on target.
It was almost like that was the turning point. I mean, it was a great save from Pickford, and, you know, Everton defended the situation. And then they come out. I don't know what happens. I'm going to say it again. I don't know what happens at halftime with this football team, because the same happened against Brighton. Within 6 minutes, they were 3-0 down, whatever it was. And then first thing that Southampton do is they lump the ball up against the three or two of the Everton centre-halves, two of the three at the back. Adams wins it, and no one is tracking Ward-Prowse. No one is tracking. And if anyone else had scored that goal with the way that he cut inside Ben Godfrey and slid the ball home, then we'd be talking about it again for quite a long time.
Imagine a Spurs first half, Everton second half team that you could watch. Didn't Lampard? What's gonna happen, Wilson?
I mean, he seems to be one of the less unpopular bits at Everton at the minute. I've seen nothing in his managerial career that makes me think he's going to be a good manager. But I also think that Everton at the moment is essentially unmanageable, and you can't really judge him on this. And the thing I don't get about Everton, I mean, clearly a lot of the boardroom decisions have not been good, and I think you can stretch that over sort of 15 years or so. But there's a lot of money being spent, and that squad is not as bad as a lot of other. You know, it's a better squad. It's got better players in it than other teams in the bottom sort of third quarter of the Premier League. But then, you know, there's all the stories about Osmanov's involvement and exactly what his relationship with Mashiri is. You know, there's a story in The Guardian yesterday suggesting Osmanov had been there when interviewing previous managers. We know that there's the business relationship between Mashiri and Osmanov has historically been very close. We know that Osmanov, his companies were sponsoring the training ground. Now, obviously, that's problematic because he's been sanctioned as a close ally of Putin, and he in theory has no involvement in the club, quite apart from bad decisions in terms of recruitment, managers, whatever else is causing it to go wrong. Yeah, that I think is a major headache for the club going forward.
The owners were advised to stay away from the ground due to concerns over their safety, which is pretty depressing. The chief executive, Denise Baxendale, was apparently put in a headlock as she left the director's box, according to club sources. You saw fans confronting players, one having a long conversation with Yerry Mina. It seemed quite a lot like a caller to Radio Merseyside, I would suspect, Noz. And that is just, you know, all that stuff is football's a game, and it's ridiculous. I don't know how, we don't need to go into it in massive detail, do we? It's a ridiculous state of affairs where owners can't, whether you like your owner or you don't, or anybody, can't go to a game for fear of their own safety. That seems pretty obvious to me.
There was a peaceful protest inside the ground. I'm not quite sure why all this information came out ahead of the game, you know, on the Saturday of the game. You know, the situation with Denise should have been dealt with. It was at the previous game, apparently, against Brighton, and you know, it's a criminal offence, and I'm not quite sure how people can get away with that with someone who's leaving the ground, I think, or leaving a director's box, and it only gets mentioned 2 weeks later. The stuff with the players, listen, I've been there before, and I know that when there is trouble like this, players are directed to another exit, and they're told to leave by that route because the fans are waiting for them out in front. So I'm not quite sure how the situation with Mina and Anthony Gordon, they were chasing Anthony Gordon down the road. He'd driven into what seemed like a blocked off road. And I don't understand how these situations manifest themselves. What happened inside the stadium was a simple protest that unfortunately clubs like Everton are always going to do because they feel that the club is being run in a disgraceful state. Whether they're right or wrong is another matter. Well, that's another story. But what happened with all that information coming out ahead of the game only riled up those fans even more and only made the situation even worse.
I mean, I completely agree with Troy there. Again, like, as with Troy, I don't understand why that information was brought out before the game. Like, if anything, I think that just throws oil onto the whole situation. I just feel really sorry for Everton fans because they... they're trying to be as organised as possible. They're trying to communicate their concerns in a rational way as possible. like you say, they're not going after the manager. They're not going after the easy target. They're explaining exactly why they're unhappy. They factored in and they appreciate the fact that a lot of money has been spent, and yet they are still concerned, and they are concerned about the board and decisions that are made. And yet now everyone is talking about a situation where a few idiots have gone too far, and that's really not fair. And I think with certain clubs and a certain set of fans, there can be almost like a ridiculing of what they're sort of arguing for. So it can be like, oh, why don't Everton fans shut up? Because they should be grateful they're in the Premier League and my club is in like whatever division or whatever. Like, it's all relative. Like, all Everton fans want to do is go to a game on a weekend and sort of enjoy it to some extent. The thing with any protest is like, fan groups always disagree and there's loads of little factions. Again, Everton fans have tried to organise and mobilise, and they've got various factions within their sort of fan base together to sort of fight this cause in a really strategic way. And I just don't want them to be dismissed. I don't want them to be dismissed because there's been certain sort of isolated issues with trouble, and even stopping sort of players in the street, like outside the cars or whatever. Even that situation, they were being reasonable. They were self-policing. Like, I could hear fans saying he's got a kid in the car, like calm down. Like, they were self-policing. So and again, this thing about fans and it relates to the Spurs fan sort of kicking Ramsdale. It's like, I think in this current sort of climate where we've got a totalitarian government and we've got people who are ready to, again, treat fans like they're idiots and sort of curb any kind of protest, you've got to be so careful not to overreact, because protest is important and fans are important. Like, they're stakeholders. So this thing about, and it's right to say fans don't always know what's happening within a club, but they still demand answers, and they should be given answers.
I'd probably, duty bound to say, some people would argue we don't live in a totalitarian state, but you made some very good points there, Noz, and that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll rattle through the rest of the Premier League games. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's go through the rest of the games then. Wolves beat West Ham 1-0. Daniel Pedence scoring just after half-time. Tom says, given Moyes' poor form, would it be wise for West Ham to sack him now, find a replacement, and then bring Moyes back in March to save them for the third time? I mean, we already mentioned this. West Ham-Everton is huge, Wilson, isn't it? But West Ham do sort of a bit like, you know, teams that don't seem to have a plan B. I don't really know what West Ham are really ever trying to do. And that seems like quite a fall from last year, where my mind tells me they were quite good.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a historical thing that you've seen with Moyes, that with players, with either British players or players of British experience, people who are used to that approach, he does very well, and he can take them to, you know, sixth, seventh in the table. As soon as you try and make that more complicated, you bring in players from a different background, so people like Scamacca or Paquetá, he's, or Didier Ndong, speaking from a Sunderland point of view, he seems to really struggle to connect with them. And I sort of feel that's what's happened this season, that by trying to step up a level, they've ended up going backwards, that they've lost the solidity and the energy and the drive in the organisation that made them good over the past two seasons. And they haven't actually been able to add, you know, the quality that they've added hasn't really been able to show itself. And, you know, I think we saw that to an extent with Moyes at Everton, that and football was a pretty different game back then, that every attempt to step up from being the, you know, really well-organised, really hard-working team didn't quite work.
Are you saying you need Moyes, then Potter, then De Zerbi? That's the sort of run that your team needs for sort of ultimate success.
Yes, that's exactly what I'd say, yeah.
So should Everton get Moyes in now?
You know? Well, I mean, the problem with that is that you're going back is... I mean, I know Moyes has done it at West Ham, but going back is never easy, is it? It's always memories of past times are not always useful. and how things were in the past. But I think it's a genuine thing that you need different types of managers at different stages of your development, and transitioning from one to the next. It's a, because of this sort of an understandable desire not to get rid of somebody who's ostensibly done a good job, and a desire to show loyalty. It's a really, really difficult thing to do. And I think West Ham have mismanaged that attempt to step up, but they've mismanaged it in a totally understandable way. I don't think they're seriously in relegation trouble, but they've taken, is it 1 point from 7 games now? 6 games?
I mean, they are 18th.
Yeah, I mean, okay, that does sound like trouble, in fairness.
Yeah. But their squad
should not be in that kind of trouble.
But it is. Lopetegui getting a tune out of Wolves at the moment, so that's a good win for them. Forest 2, Leicester 0. Troy, Morgan Gibbs-White and Brennan Johnson were both excellent in this game. And actually that goal where Gibbs-White, you know, does really well to get out of a tight space, play that ball the outside of his foot, and Johnson's first touch, I think it's the second goal, was so good.
Morgan Gibbs-White is all over my notes. You know, remember his fee. Remember the fact that, you know, we struggled to start with, as a lot of the, I don't know how many, was it 22 signings that Forrest did, but he's coming into his own now, and he's proven his worth, and it could be the best amount of money that Forrest have spent during that window in the summer. And his connection with Johnson is brilliant. You know, both goals came from those two. Johnson's a live wire anyway. He's, you know, he runs in and beyond defences, and when he goes, he's hardly ever caught, and his composure in front of goal is brilliant. But Gibbs-White is running Nottingham Forest's midfield. Well, he's playing in a kind of Jesse Lingard position. I know Lingard's injured at the moment, I believe, but if you're going to compare the two, Gibbs-White has really stepped up this season, while Lingard hasn't performed to any kind of part of his ability at all.
It's so really bad luck for Jesse Lingard for somebody to be playing really well in the Jesse Lingard position at the same club as Jesse Lingard and not be Jesse Lingard.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, listen, I think you just mentioned from 20th to 13th, there's only 5 points. Forest sit at 13th. Southampton, who, you know, have seemed to have, well, you know, Jones has got his first win, and they see, you know, after beating Man City as well, there seems to be an upward trajectory there. But I like the job Cooper's doing. It was always going to take time to mould and get that team in his style. The club have stuck with him after everyone thought that he was going to get the sack. And I think you're seeing the results there, and long may that continue for them.
Leicester were in great form, Noz, before the World Cup. 5 wins in 6. Is it as simple as no James Maddison? I mean, if your best player isn't there, that does make a difference, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it does, but also like watching them play, they just don't seem motivated, or they don't seem to have bought into sort of what's happening at the moment. And it's one of those, you talk about sort of managers who could be in trouble, like that could be the next one to go, to be honest, because like it just doesn't seem to be working at all. There's just a malaise, and it's almost a case of you look forward to like who's going to be on Match of the Day and like what the running order is going to be. It's kind of like they don't seem asked about, sort of like it's almost as if like they sort of like give it a miss themselves. Like if they were on telly, they'd sort of like sack it off. Like there just seems to be a lot of indifference at the moment. And I don't think it's just one player. I think there's bigger issues there.
Well, I think the thing with Rodgers is that there was sort of talk about him getting sacked earlier in the season, and the understanding was that the owner's business, their business is duty-free shops in airports, which obviously were hammered during the pandemic when nobody was travelling. So they basically, the money supply was very straitened, and that they couldn't afford to sack Rodgers earlier in the season. But I think we're now getting to a point where they've got to look at which is the bigger loss, the payoff they've got to give Rodgers or relegation, which costs more. And so I think a situation where there was a bit of security, albeit you know, almost by default for Rodgers early in the season, maybe we're entering a period where that calculation has changed.
Who is buying stuff from duty free? I mean, it's just you've got through security and you've just got this windy, perfumey, you know, people trying to give you like bourbon at 7 a.m. Like, who isn't just trying to get through that as quickly as possible? Like, what? Maybe it's just me. But like, how?
You have destroyed Leicester City Football Club with that kind of attitude.
I'm amazed if the world was sensible, that wouldn't be a great way of making money, because nobody, you just want to get through and get a pret.
I think with Duty Free, everyone's bored, everyone's got time in their hands, everyone turns into Todd Bowie and just starts buying stuff for no reason whatsoever.
To St James's Park then, how's your luck, Newcastle? That Mitrovic penalty, Troy. I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Because you watch it going, he's sort of done a John Terry, but he scored. Oh, that's lucky. And then, do you think that should be a retake? If you double hit like that and it goes in? I felt sorry for him. Maybe I've just got an agenda. I don't know.
Well, mate, I felt sorry for him. I did feel sorry for him. It was obviously a massive moment for him at St James's Park. And I'd probably say that Fulham did, with the way that they set up and the way that they played, I know Newcastle had some really good chances and Callum Wilson, maybe with a bit more game time behind him, may have finished those. But there's two penalty decisions, weren't there? They were two massive decisions. The one that Dan Burn, after pulling back, who did he pull back? I've lost my moment there, but Pereira, wasn't it? And then the penalty that was given when Reed stepped on Trippier's foot, and was given a penalty. So it should have been the other way around. It may have been a different circumstance then. But yeah, I just felt for Mitrovic. You're watching him take it. You see it go in the net. I thought to myself, it's taken a deflection. But how can it take a deflection when there's only one player involved in it? And yeah, I'm not even sure it was a great penalty, to be totally honest. And Pope might have saved it. But because of the deflection off his left foot, I just massively felt for him. I don't know about anyone else. He's a likeable guy, Mitrovic. I love the way that he plays. Everyone thought that he wouldn't get goals in the Premier League this year, but he has done on a consistent basis. And I think it showed a mark of both teams, to be totally honest, where Fulham have stabilised themselves and the great job that's being done there. And now they're a competitive Premier League club. Well, at least for one season. We'll see if they progress from there. But then also Newcastle to stay at it, to keep at it, and to eventually get their goal to win the game late on.
I mean, Noz, we talked a lot about the ownership and how I feel about it. But Troy is right. Eddie Howe is doing a ridiculous job. I still feel, and I don't know if it's just because a lot of Newcastle fans have yelled at me on social media, and so that is colouring my judgment of what may happen. I still feel that their squad, talk about squad depth, isn't deep enough to maintain this. And there is a bit of a gap now between fourth and fifth. Maybe I'm being naive about the ability of Sean Longstaff. Maybe Eddie Howe has improved these players to such a level where they are actually, you know, gonna stick it out.
I think, to be honest, I think Newcastle fans would probably agree. Like, it kind of showed in the cup where like the first 11's really good, and playing really well together. But like after that, you do have a little bit of a drop down. Like. But I mean, how is a really good manager, and good managers find a way of solving sort of problems, and like even think about sort of turning like changing Joe Linton's position, like he finds solutions. I love the way that like and it's kind of a narrative that's kind of developed over the last few weeks of like the dark arts of Newcastle. And like, oh, they'll do anything to win, and that's a real strength. And like, you can see Howe's loving that. Like, it's the first time he's been sort of described as like a bad boy, and like, in spite of the fact he's like the second most likely manager to be on LinkedIn in the Premier League. Like, it's like he's loving it. For once, he's like the bad boy you wouldn't want to take home to mum, and like, but he really would be. He'd be lovely.
So hang on, Jesse Marsh is first, right?
Yes, Jesse Marsh has just joined LinkedIn, apparently. This is the big news. Couple more games left. Chelsea beat Palace 1-0. Huge win for Chelsea. Big goal for Kai Havertz to Palace's fifth defeat in six. But Chelsea have so many injuries, aren't they, despite spending £5 billion or whatever, you know. Badia Shah made his debut. Lewis Hall was playing. Chukwuemeka as well. Trevor Chalobah, who had a absolute shocker against Fulham on Thursday night after we recorded the last pod, but they lost. I mean, the big story about this is Mudryk turning up. Joseph, just to mention for how much of a madman Todd Bowley is, please. Isn't he fun? They've signed Mudryk from under the nose of Arsenal, a deal worth up to £89 million, an 8.5-year deal. that would take us to the end of 2029. If one listener could put a reminder in their phone, please, for the end of the Mudryk deal. I wonder what we'll all be doing then. Graham says, what will happen first? The end of Mudryk's Chelsea contract or the rise of the machines that Arnold Schwarzenegger spent so much of his life warning us about? I, for one, welcome our new Skynet overlords. Wilson, it seems that their transfer policy, I don't understand FFP. People have explained how they can still spend all this money, but it seems wild.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the 8.5-year deal, part of the logic of that is that you amortize the deal. So, you know, 85 million quid, say, over 8.5 years is 10 million a year. So it's not that much. But the flip side of that is you've got the liability of his wages every year for 8.5 years. And it might, you know, if he gets injured or if he turns out not to be as good as we think he might be, then you're lumbered with those wages in the same way they've been lumbered with Lukaku's wages. So it's a huge risk. But Mudryk, we've seen him for Shakhtar in the Champions League. He looks brilliant, but it's in the Champions League. You know, what he's doing in the Ukrainian League isn't really that relevant to how he's going to do in the Premier League. I think signing any player from Ukraine or another league of that stature is always a risk. Can he produce those levels every week? We don't know that. I think he probably is a very, very good player with that slight caveat. What I don't see is any kind of plan. And that would really worry me. I sort of think one of the beauties of football as a sport is maybe even its chief beauty is that it's not just about getting the best players, it's about getting the best blend of players. And that's a really difficult and complicated thing to achieve. And just paying more money for the bloke that another club you've heard of wants to sign probably isn't the best way to achieve that. I don't think that left-sided attacking role is where Chelsea were particularly weak. I think the back of midfield is where they desperately need support, and wing-back or full-back, particularly at the minute with Reece James and Ben Chilwell still out.
Yeah, I also, you know, Graham Potter being so naturally cautious and just looking at this litany of attacking midfielders going, I only want two of these. Like, I can't, there's just so many disappointed players. How disappointed are all the attacking midfielders going to be? It's ridiculous.
So the first formation we actually can state with some confidence is in 1872 when England went to play Scotland and drew 0-0. They played a 1-2-7, but they played two left wingers and only one right winger. Now, what we don't know is, was that just the players who were available, or was that a regular plan? Because if you have right foot players at the back hitting long balls, they naturally would drift left. What I quite like is the idea that Bowley's decided to educate himself on tactics, and he's still on chapter one, and he thinks, well, we'll play this 1-2-7. We'll overload the left side. We'll just play these long sweeping balls from right to left. And also, maybe that'll work, because I'm reckoning not a lot of defences have seen that.
True. But they could play 1-2-7 and still, like, Pulisic or Ziyech could be on the bench going, well, this is totally ridiculous. Brentford beat Bournemouth 2-0. Jamie says, bit of a Ramos to PSG moment for me when I realised Bournemouth win the Premier League. Quite sure I haven't heard any of their results and I haven't noticed them while perusing the Premier League table. Well, I've had the Gary O'Neill story. And we know Brentford are, you know, a good, solid Premier League team now. Bournemouth, I feel Noz, Bournemouth are sinking.
With no disrespect, and that usually means massive disrespect. Like, I sometimes forget they're two different teams. So, like, it's always useful when they do play that I realised, like, those are two different teams. And, like, it's almost like they're two brothers and, like, Brentford are now the slightly better looking one. That's how you can tell them apart. So, I felt so bad because, like, there's so much football on all the time. Like every single day, and it's both amazing and sort of like too much, and like you could see on like social media, like people just thought, right, I'm having a rest for this one, I'm sitting this one out, like there's been too much, this is the one I'll miss.
So yeah, Villa beat Leeds 2-1 on Friday night. Emma says, when you talk about Leeds, please can you say more than they were a bit unlucky? Two wins in 17, we can see two a game. Jesse Marsh has shown no sign of being able to fix the obvious problems in his system. We are completely reliant on Nonto, who he said wasn't Premier League ready in August. It's funny, Troy, because I thought Leeds were a bit unlucky against Aston Villa.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter, does it? Ultimately, it's results that matter. And like I've just said about clubs in transition, Leeds are a club in transition that is not going very well. And 2-17 normally puts the manager under a lot of pressure. So that's probably why he has joined LinkedIn, because he could potentially need another role soon. Listen, it was defensively again. I always worry about Leeds. I always worry about the leakages in their defensive back line. They were unlucky, but ultimately results. You don't see that against the result. You don't see the scoreline, and then but how lucky Leeds were. You see the scoreline, and you know that they've lost another game. So important that they try and get some results. Good to see Patrick Bamford back, by the way. I think they've missed him. I think they are in for a striker, and they probably should have been long before now. But good to see him back and getting on the end of an opportunity, because they're going to need him in the running. They're going to need a fit Patrick Bamford, because it's not going to get any easier for them, that's for sure.
I'm not on LinkedIn. Is anyone here on LinkedIn?
I am, yeah.
You're on LinkedIn? Is it? I mean, yeah. Are lots of football managers on there? Like, is Alan Kirbishley on LinkedIn? Is that a good place for a football manager to be? Like, surely that's not how football managers get jobs, is it?
I'm always surprised that there's certain players on there who put free agent. They may not be obviously the biggest players, they're players down the leagues, but they have on their free agent available, you know, as of today. But yeah, to see, unless he's running a business, I don't know if he's got a business on the side or whatever else, but yeah, I'm
quite
surprised.
Are you linked in with him? Is that what it's called?
I am not linked in with him, no. I'm not, okay. No. I only found out the other day when I saw one of the tweets, so I may link in with him and see what his content is all about.
And does he accept your link?
He has to accept me, yeah, he has to accept me.
Right, okay.
So if I press the button. If he presses the button, then I have to accept him.
LinkedIn is purely business. There's no like
not necessarily
photos or like offensive opinions about, you know, climate change or whatever.
To be honest, Max, it's changed from where it was as a business platform to just another platform where if you want to be angry, you can be angry. If you want to be crude, you can be crude. It's changed from where it was, that's for sure.
Anyway, that's all we have time for. Thank you, Troy.
Pleasure, Max, as always.
Thank you, Wilson.
Cheers, thank you.
Thanks, Noz.
All right, pleasure.
The Guardian Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens.
This is The Guardian.